From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. We're going to begin this edition of the Politics Hour in an unusual way because this has been an unusual week in Washington and because the events that so many of you watched at the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing yesterday occurred in this region. We're going to ask you right now, what do you think of the calls for an investigation in Maryland by Democratic Maryland lawmakers and even Republican Governor Larry Hogan? Political posturing on all sides, or is there something there? We don't know exactly what Governor Hogan is calling for. That's one of the things we'll be discussing in this broadcast. But did you watch the Kavanaugh hearings yesterday? What did you think? Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Also in studio with us is Erin Cox. She's a Maryland politics reporter with the Washington Post. Erin, good to see you.
Thanks. Good to see you too.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with the chair of the Arlington County Board, Katie Crystal. But you can start calling with your comments right now. Erin, yesterday Governor Larry Hogan called on the U.S. Senate to delay the vote on Kavanaugh nomination, but what exactly is he calling for?
He's calling for an unspecified full investigation into the allegations against Judge Kavanaugh. He hasn't said who should investigate. He has said very clearly he doesn't think it should be the Maryland State Police. And he's speaking through a spokesperson here. And his position is that there needs to be a comprehensive investigation before any vote is taken.
Just last week, the governor declined a request from State Senator Cheryl Kagan, who represents Montgomery County, to have the Maryland State Police investigate Christine Blasey Ford's allegations. Are Democratic lawmakers still seeking Maryland police involvement, and is that even a possibility at this point?
You know, he said that using the state police in this manner would be, you know, indulging some sort of personal whim, and that was a road he didn't want to go down. The governor did. At this point, Democratic lawmakers are asking for the Montgomery County Police, the jurisdiction where this alleged assault against Christine Ford took place 36 years ago, asking them to look into it. And so far, the police have not said that whether they will or they won't, but they've said very clearly that they won't do anything unless a victim comes forward and asks them to investigate.
And there is no statute of limitations. I know I want to hear from the people who are calling in. I watched all of it yesterday. And I think the most important thing now, when you people on the left and right and middle and the center on all of this, one of the largest developments, which I think a lot of people still haven't even heard, is that the American Bar Association, which routinely vets judges and their suitability people to be judges, has called on the Senate not to vote on the Kavanaugh nomination until a full investigation by the FBI is done into Dr. Ford's allegations and any others that may arise, saying that it's important for the independence of the court system, and it also would take it outside of all this political back and forth should the ABA's call be paid attention to by the Republican majority in the Senate.
Erin, Governor Hogan is one of four Republican governors breaking rank with his party. It includes former presidential candidate and Trump opponent John Kasich. How much of this new call to investigate Trump's nominee is political on both the Democrats and on Hogan's side?
Well, I don't know inside of his head exactly what the calculus is here, but I can definitely describe what the political benefit is here. Several of the governors who have called for this, Governor Phil Scott in Vermont, a Democratic-leaning state, Republican Governor Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, a Democratic-leaning state, and Larry Hogan here in Maryland, all three are Republican governors running in Democratic states. And so taking the position that an investigation needs to come first is a way to kind of distance yourself from some of the parts of the Republican Party that voters in these Democratic states find the most offensive. That it has a political benefit that by calling for an investigation, you're not saying don't confirm him. You're not saying I believe the allegations. I don't believe the allegations. You're just calling for an investigation. And the benefit of doing that is it says that we want to hear everybody first, and that Democratic voters can see there's some light between some of the leaders on Capitol Hill and Donald Trump and their positions.
And this is consistent with Governor Hogan's, what I've said here. It's his attempt to wrap himself in political bubble wrap involved the Trump issues and all the controversies out of Washington. He's still ahead in the polls. He's still in most. Mason-Dixon has just come out. This also, it can be, it's not that he has a bad motive. This could be a very good motive to say, let's have more information. Because again, I say the American Bar Association, the ABA, is not a trifling matter here when it says there ought to be more done before the vote's done. So
right.
He's right. So he's going to align himself with the ABA.
Right. And I just want to be clear here. We don't know Governor Hogan's motives. This, you know, he could be calling for an investigation because he believes that's the best public policy. It just also happens to come with a political benefit. And just real quick, Tom, there is now a no statute of limitations on an attempted assault, like what was described 35 years ago. But in 1982 in Maryland, there was, in fact, a one-year, it was a misdemeanor, and it would have been a one-year statute of limitations. And so any sort of criminal investigation brought by the local government now, that's one of the many hurdles that it would have to overcome, is at the time when the incident was alleged to take place, there was only a one-year statute of limitations.
Thank you for that. That's
one
important.
Of the intriguing things about this is that in response to the response from Democratic members of the General Assembly, the police chief of Montgomery County, or their letter, indicated that the investigation should be conducted if the individual or individuals who are making the claims are in agreement with it. But in the state of Maryland, I know of only one individual making such a charge, and that's Dr. Blasey Ford.
That is true. The client of Michael Avenatti, who people are familiar with as the lawyer of Stormy Daniels, he represents a woman who said that she was gang raped at a house party also in the early 80s and has alleged in an affidavit that Judge Kavanaugh was present along with Mark Judge, the kind of one of the other characters in this story. And so that is another incident that that potentially could be investigated if the victim chose to do that. And the lawmakers sent this letter not only to the Montgomery County Police, but also to Deborah Katz, the attorney for Ms. Ford, and also to Michael Avenatti, who represents the other woman who alleged that she was victimized here.
Here is Mark in Ashburn. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. So, you know, what really struck me about watching the meeting yesterday was that, you know, Republicans allowed this to go through up to this point, and we essentially are trying somebody, you know, in front of the entire nation and being tried by senators on both sides who are not investigators. You know, essentially all it does is turn it into a he said, she said, in the meantime, we have the FBI there that could go ahead and move forward with an investigation. And the precedent is there in that in the past, that's exactly what has been done.
Yeah, but somebody's got to ask for it, Tom.
Right, you know, the senator role, the 100 senators, their role is to advise and consent on the nomination. The FBI role is not to decide whether the person is guilty or not, but to get as much possible information as it can gather so that the senators can make the best possible decision apart from any politics. And that's where we are now. The Democrats keep saying there should be more FBI involvement. The Republicans, if you believe the hardcore politics of it, the Republicans have an extraordinary, maybe once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for themselves to really change the nature of the U.S. Supreme Court, and they do not want to be slowed down or stopped in any way. I know some very good conservative Christian folks that I know. One of them is my brother. And he says all of this stuff either about Trump or about they want the court to be changed, and they're going to put up with a lot of this angst right now, even if it costs people votes in November to make this historic decades-long change on the Supreme Court.
Here is Catherine in Tacoma Park. Catherine, your turn.
Hi, Kojo. How are you?
Doing well.
I think that Judge Kavanaugh proved himself unworthy of serving on the Supreme Court just based on his testimony yesterday. He was rude, aggressive. He spouted off weird paranoia about a left-wing.
So you think this gets to the issue of temperament?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
You think this gets to the issue of temperament?
Well, I think it gets to the issue of temperament, but also he was incredibly partisan. He was harassing the Democratic senators, ridiculing them, and he was very respectful to the Republicans. So I think that it just occurred to me that this guy does not have the temperament to be nonpartisan, to be able to judge fairly on the Supreme Court or maybe even any court.
Thank you very much for your call. On to Nova in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Nova, your turn.
Hi, Kojo. I just also kind of wanted to echo what Kathleen just said about his temperament being really, really rude. And also, you know, the way that he didn't really want to follow through like a sort of due process. I'm not really familiar with the lingo, but a due process like investigation and to look into this. And I mean, it just seems really, really hypocritical for a judge to do something like that. And also what this says for women and in the future to come, if this is a lifetime sort of, you know, position, like how okay. are women going to feel safe in this country?
Okay. Thank you very much for your call. We're going to have to break pretty soon, Aaron, but I got to get back to some regional politics. On Monday, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan and Democratic gubernatorial candidate Ben Jealous met for their only debate of this election. In 30 seconds or so, what are your impressions of the performances of the two candidates?
Man, that's a taller order than either of them had in that debate. You know, Ben Jealous had a lot to gain. Larry Hogan had a lot to lose. He's, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20 points up in the polls, depending on who you look at. He's a lot better funded. And so my takeaway from the debate is that these two gentlemen definitely do not like each other. They see a very different state. Larry Hogan sees one that's doing well economically and then making a lot of progress on a lot of different fronts and that it should keep moving in that direction. Ben Jealous sees one that where a lot of working families have been left behind, and he's proposing a lot of sweeping ideas to try to move them forward. Because he's so far behind in the polls, Ben Jealous did a really good job articulating himself and his story. And Larry Hogan, who was very far ahead, did an excellent job not making any huge gaffes that could have cut dramatically into his lead.
Fareed, we got to take that break. Okay. Hold that thought, Tom Sherwood. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation. Joining us will be Katie Crystal, chair of the Arlington County Board. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back to the Politics Hour. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for a Washington City paper. Guest analyst is Erin Cox. She's a Maryland politics reporter with the Washington Post. And joining us now in studio is Katie Crystal, chair of the Arlington County Board. Chair Crystal, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to join you. Thanks.
Katie Crystal, yesterday people across the country watched the testimony of the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. We're hearing about a strong uptick in calls to local sexual assault hotlines. Are you hearing that in Arlington?
We absolutely are. We're hearing it from our providers who do both accompaniment services and from our partners that do medical and forensic analysis services. It's the silver lining of these really difficult national conversations is that it gives survivors a name for what happened to them and encourages them to reach out for help.
You're going to say, Tom?
Well, no, I'm just going to say I have family members who have posted on Facebook things that I would never have known, not just about sexual abuse, but about abuse in general of
Absolutely.
Mistreatment of women. Have you watched the hearings from yesterday? Were you able to watch? What is your own view of it?
I've actually been listening. I had one of my usual 12-hour days of meetings yesterday, so was riveted to WAMU whenever I could in my car to listen to the coverage. And
Are you a member?
I am a member.
Good. But I ask in part because part of your record on your Facebook and your page is you've been involved in sexual abuse issues for more than a decade. And so I want to ask you what you thought of that yesterday,
Absolutely.
Apart from the politics of it.
Yeah. So I've about a decade and a half now. I started as a peer advocate in college. And one of the things that we emphasize then that remains as true as ever is that believing survivors, and I do believe Dr. Ford, is not just a matter of feminist principle. It's substantiated by research. You know, the FBI collects its crime victimization data, and it does investigate levels of different crimes, how often they're unsubstantiated or proven to be false, and depends on what segments you take, and different studies have yielded different specific figures. But on balance, what we know to be true is that rape is no more likely to be falsely reported than any other violent crime. That has been true for the 14 years I've been involved in this issue. I think it's been true dating before it, and it's certainly true today. And so one of the reasons I care so much about these issues and want to make sure that Arlington has a full range of supportive services for survivors is that the far bigger problem is underreporting.
Dr. Fort was said to be, she was obviously, you could see the emotion she was struggling with, but she was contained and she gave a rational response to what she wanted to say. Judge Kavanaugh, on the other hand, was far from judicial in that he was crying at some point. He was loud. He was a combative. He was certainly not temperamentally judged in that situation. Of course, he's fighting for his own life. Did you take any notice of that in particular?
I do think it was incredibly interesting to see both the temperament on display, and generally my assessment is consistent with the one you've described here, but also see the way that we react to them, right? The way that we as a society react to the behavior of both survivors and accused in rape trials has changed to some extent over the years, and to some extent it's part of the reason women, and there are of course men who survive sexual assault, are often reticent to come forward. They know that their behavior will be judged if their story is in any way inconsistent. That will be held under a microscope, et cetera. And so I think Dr. Ford really represented the sort of standard to which we do hold sexual assault survivors to deliver their stories clearly and with full recollection of the details.
We got an email from L. Burns who says, listening to the hearing, I was taken by the tactic of turning the case from a sexual assault on a woman to a political attack on a man. Instead of Dr. Blasey Ford being the victim of Kavanaugh's sexual assault, the Republicans staged the hearing as an attack on Kavanaugh by the Democrats, which conveniently changed the subject. Dr. Blasey Ford was a mere accessory. What do you feel about that?
That's an interesting analysis. One of the things that has been really striking to me is how effectively the defenders of Brett Kavanaugh seem to have created this frame of innocent until proven guilty, et cetera, where does the preponderance of the evidence lead us, beyond reasonable doubt, et cetera. It's easy to forget that nobody is trying Brett Kavanaugh with the threat of imprisonment or punishment. The question is whether he should be a member of the United States Supreme Court, one of the most powerful bodies in this nation. And I think the standards actually should be a little bit different.
And that's why I go back before you got here. The American Bar Association has said the FBI should take a further look at all these allegations. That's neither left nor right. That's the bar which passes judgment on all sorts of judicial nominations.
And to your point, given that this is not a court of criminal law and no one's trying to prove innocence or guilt, I'm curious what you think about the benefit of having an investigation either by Maryland law enforcement or the Maryland State Police or the FBI and deeper into this, given that, you know, the job of the senators here is to determine whether or not he is fit to sit on the Supreme Court. From your perspective as an advocate for sexual assault survivors, what is the benefit of doing such an investigation?
Well, I think the best answer is the one that we started with, right, to just characterize how emotionally fraught and wrought the conversation has become. This is, I think, the worst way to hear out an accusation of sexual assault is to turn it into a he said, she said, which is essentially the forum that's been created in the Senate. And I think the value of an investigation is that it does take it out of that realm. If you'll allow me, I'd love to just take a moment and make sure that survivors in Arlington County know that if they do choose to come forward, whether it's been inspired by this event or any other, that they
That's
can...
That's where I was going.
Wonderful. I would be remiss if I didn't share that there is a wide array of services available to them. We've improved them significantly in the past few years, whether they choose to pursue a law enforcement avenue, seek medical support, get a forensic exam done, or just want crisis support and accompaniment and counseling. They should call 703-237-0881. They can also
say the number again.
703-237-0881.
Tom, write slowly. Arlington County is launching a community outreach effort to raise awareness about services survivors of sexual assaults can access, which you've just been describing. Was this specifically in response to this national conversation?
No. In fact, this effort is about a decade in the making. We created a community response or interagency response to domestic violence and then added sexual assault to that charge about a decade ago. That's called Project Peace, Partnering to End Abuse in the Community for Everyone. And the first thing that needed to happen was the breakdown of a lot of silos about how services were delivered for survivors. We needed to improve the counseling support services. We had a non 24-hour hotline, which was a problem and patchworky up until about 2015. And we had insufficient medical and forensic services for survivors at Inova Hospital. So we've been working to bolster and improve that. Those are now 24/7 with very little wait times for individuals to get those services. So what we have sought to do with the brand new sexual assault response team protocol, which was signed just on Wednesday, the timing was somewhat coincidental, but I'm glad to have this opportunity to talk about it, is sign a protocol that basically says no matter what door a survivor comes through, whether they call the police, whether they seek help from the victim witness program in our prosecutor's office, whether they call our counseling hotline, the number I just shared, or whether they show up at the hospital, they should have consistent expectations about how they'll be treated, what their rights are, the cost of those services. Everything I've mentioned so far is free. And what they can expect throughout the process, where they'll have choices, for example, about whether to prosecute, go forward, or just receive care. So what's so exciting about this protocol and the documents that will accompany it is that we finally have a chance to bring the community in and do this sort of education about all of the interagency work that's helping get us to this point.
Is there a website?
There is. If people go to arlingtonva.us and search PEACE, again, that's the acronym, but PEACE is in bringing peace to survivors in the community. They can find comprehensive information. They can find a brand new brochure and wallet card in both English and Spanish and everything that I've said. And we have a number of avenues through which we'll be trying to push the print materials out to the community. Okay. But I hope they'll visit the site.
Go ahead.
This is the Politics Hour. I saw you on Labor Day at the Lyon Park Democratic Party gathering. Democrats are enthusiastic about the November 6th elections. What do you think this means in the raw core politics of people talk about suburban women voting? What are you hearing and seeing in terms of how the politics will play out from this, President Trump in general, and in Virginia politics on November the 6th?
I have to tell you, this is true in Arlington, although Arlington, as you know, is very progressive,
People's
right?
Republic
71% Democratic.
71% Democratic. And in fact, I was just looking at these statistics apropos of the announcement that the Trump headquarters is thinking about Arlington.
Well, just get your voters out.
That's exactly right.
As much as maybe the Trump voters might.
That's right. But what I was going to observe is not only are Arlingtonians incredibly fired up, I do a lot of work both on policy and politics across the region, and I've never seen anything like this with Northern Virginia women. So it's not just the higher Democratic precincts of Arlington and Alexandria. It is Loudoun and Prince William and Fairfax. There's just an unbelievable amount of energy. I think that is certainly dovetailed both opposition to Trump and many of his policies. That is dovetailed with the Me Too movement. And now they have come together in the perfect storm of a very clear message that the Republican Senate majority doesn't believe women or trust women. And yeah. I think you'll see a response to that in November.
The incident that the Senate Judiciary Committee was considering yesterday happened in this region among high school students teaching consent in schools, a concept that did not exist in Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford's high school days, is now central to college campus sexual assault prevention. But how many public and middle and high schools teach it as well, including in Brett Kavanaugh's home state of Maryland? How is Arlington dealing with sexual assault and harassment in the middle and high school years, and do schools teach consent?
That's such an interesting question. It resonates with me personally. I, too, grew up in the Maryland suburbs in the 90s rather than the 80s when Brett Kavanaugh and Dr. Ford were growing up. But the characterizations was absolutely my experience. There was very little taught in the way of consent. The vanguard on this in Arlington Public Schools is actually students themselves. We have something called the Healthy Relationships Task Force that launched, I'd say, about 3 years ago, a campaign that they're calling Consent Is. And it's peer-to-peer education about what healthy relationships look like. That's designed to prevent not only sexual abuse, but also all kinds of intimate partner violence. I don't believe I need to consult with my school board counterparts. I don't believe it's a formal part of the adopted curriculum yet, but we've seen a tremendous amount of peer-to-peer education in the form of classroom talks, school assemblies, and tablings. For example, I know there was a huge presence at Back to School Night in the past couple of weeks of that peer-to-peer education about consent.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have in this segment. Erin Cox, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Erin is a Maryland politics reporter with the Washington Post. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Katie Crystal, chair of the Arlington County Board. And of course, we'll continue talking about what happened in this region that has the Senate Judiciary Committee maybe voting on today. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back to the Politics Hour. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Katie Crystal is chair of the Arlington County Board. Chair Crystal, earlier this week, Arlington County Manager Mark Schwartz told the county board that the next fiscal year is going to be particularly tough. Said that last year, too. He expects a gap of between $20 and $35 million in the 2020 budget. Do you share his concerns, and do you agree with his assessment about the coming budget?
We absolutely share his concerns, and the only thing that that dire picture doesn't include is how big the anticipated growth or the anticipated gap between revenue and needs will be on the school side as well.
$43 million.
So,
what is the overall budget while we talk about this? If this is a gap, what is your overall general budget for Arlington?
Sure, we are at about between 1.3 and 1.5 billion.
Okay.
So it's a pretty significant share of it. It's a great question for framing. You know, what we're seeing in Arlington is that there is a structural gap between the growth in revenues and the growth in needs of services for our community. And that's largely attributable to the continuing challenges of a very high office vacancy rate, which remains about 20% in Arlington County.
Well, that's a perfect segue into the news story. The Washington Business Journal and others have said that the Crystal City, which has a high vacancy rate. Is it 40%? It's a huge number.
No, it's not that bad. It's about 20%.
Okay, well, that's a
You mean the Crystal City
Crystal
submarket.
City is bigger than the 20% in Arlington.
That's true. It's, I think, probably around the 20 or 21 mark.
Well, there's a news story out, and I know you can't confirm it, but that Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, may buy JBG, which is the principal real estate company in Crystal City, owns 21 buildings, millions of square feet. They could just create Amazon City there. I know you don't know whether that's going to happen or not, but are you preparing in case it does? And if so, what can you do politically and administratively to be ready if this happens? He said, as recently in his conversation here in Washington, Bezos did, he will make the announcement before the end of the year. That's not very long.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a real symmetry here, right, with the size of the this potential economic development opportunity and the hole in our budget that we were discussing. I think what might surprise people to know is if Amazon were to locate 8 million square feet of office in Crystal City tomorrow, all that would do is return us to pre-BRAC levels of office occupancy.
And BRAC was when the base realignment, when a lot of federal agencies and military people were taken were consolidated elsewhere outside of Crystal City.
Absolutely. So it's, I think, you know, one of the things we're seeking to communicate is just how large a deficit we're operating at. And that's why we're seeing such a significant impact on our budget. So, you know, I would never want to be flip about the potential impact on a community of such a large economic development tenant locating in Arlington. But it's also really important to understand the context in how badly we need to fill such a significant magnitude of space. So, you know,
you'll get the tax revenue from that. That would help support the school and the infrastructure.
Exactly.
It's all one pie.
That's exactly right. You know, Arlingtonians, we've been pretty fortunate in recent years. We've had a pretty good split, about 50-50 between our revenue coming from residential taxpayers and commercial taxpayers. And that means we've been able to really enjoy incredibly high standards of schools, parks, public safety, all kinds of resources, while having the lowest tax rate in the region. And so we would certainly rather shore up that office vacancy problem and that commercial side of the 50% split, then we would have to ask our taxpayers to make the choice between paying more or receiving less. So that's
I don't know how much this will help your office vacancy problem, but President Trump is reportedly scouting out office space in Arlington for his 2020 campaign headquarters. Would you welcome him coming to Arlington?
Well, let me stay on message about Arlington's office vacancy rate just long enough to say that I'm not surprised that anyone looking to locate a headquarters would look at Arlington and Roslyn. We have excellent transportation, great views of the district to offer. The only point I would make is usually we really boast our talent in Arlington as a great form of attraction for businesses, but considering that fewer than one in six Arlingtonians actually voted for Donald Trump and that so much of our talent comes internationally, I don't know that they'd be drawing on that talent pool. So, we're very eager to fill that office space, but I don't know that that's a tenant I would be particularly excited to see in Arlington.
Given the fiscal forecast for Arlington, do you think that Arlington County homeowners might expect to pay higher real estate taxes moving forward?
I think for our conversation about the fiscal 20 budget, that is a very real and, in fact, likely possibility. We took great strides last year. It was very important to my colleagues and to me to not raise the tax rate. And so we, in fact, cut or reallocated about $14 million in our budget. So everything that we thought we could do to create efficiencies, or we made some really difficult choices. For example, we substantially decreased our economic support and job training programs in Arlington, as well as others. So a lot of those, I wouldn't even characterize them as easy choices, but real choices have already been made. At this point, to close a deficit of the size that our county manager and our superintendent is forecasting without tax increases would be cause cuts that I think would be profoundly felt. It would be equivalent to, for example, laying off a tenth of our workforce in Arlington
County. What is the, in your $1.3 billion budget, what is the principal sources of that money? Is it real estate, residential? Residential and commercial real estate? Is that the principal?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, that's the principal driver of revenue. Right.
Dockless bikes and scooters are a regular sight in this region. And on Tuesday, the Arlington County Board voted unanimously to launch a trial program. How do you see bikes and scooters fitting into the larger transportation ecosystem in Arlington County?
Well, I would say in general, Arlington has been very open to alternative forms of transportation, and we've generally seen that those are things that coexist with and build on one another. Bike share improves rates of metro usage, for example, and so forth. We are proceeding with caution on the electric scooters. We have heard many, many opinions and many strongly held opinions about these devices that showed up and showed up fast in our community. And people have raised very fair concerns about them, about safety, about whether they're being left in the right of way.
We've had a death in the district.
Exactly. We followed that closely. And so it was important to my colleagues and to me, as well as to our professional staff and to some of our expert advisors in the community with our Transportation Commission and others, that we not react in a knee-jerk way, that we neither ban them altogether nor simply open the floodgates and let them run rampant. And so I think we're really pleased that we're able to advance with this pilot project so that when we do seek to maybe make legislative or policy changes about e-scooters and e-bikes, that we're doing so not just based on the opinions we've heard, but on data.
So a pilot project. Right now, if I got one of the scooters in Georgetown and I went across the Key Bridge into Arlington, Roslyn, what are the rules for me for riding that on the sidewalks, on the streets? Are there any rules? And that's what the pilot project going to do?
Absolutely. So right now the scooters may not be used on our trails, and that's actually consistent
not on the trails.
On the trails,
okay.
That's actually consistent.
No motorized vehicles on the trails.
Exactly. That's our current code. Beyond that, what we're exploring is the things we might want to put into code, but we're not creating any rules until we can gather the data from the pilot.
So if I can ride my scooter on your streets and on your sidewalks?
You can do that. We have included speed limits in the pilot, and that's the expectation. We have included requirements that any business that's going to operate or allow their scooters to be operated in Arlington have to pick up improperly parked scooters within 1 hour. So if somebody leaves a scooter in the right of way or near your home, first of all, we'd encourage
Can we do that for cars too?
That would be especially exciting. But the expectation is that they'll be quickly moved. And then the thing that we really want to study is the potential impacts to pedestrians, cyclists, motorists, and others, whether it makes sense to corral them in some way and so forth.
But they can go 15 so miles downhill, 20 miles an hour. People are wearing them without helmets, without elbow or shin guards or any type of safety.
Absolutely. The safety concerns are real. I think most of the examples we've seen thus far have been collisions between scooters and cars, vehicles. And so
right.
That's probably the area we'll be most deeply studying. But absolutely, we're really interested in the potential impacts or hoping to avoid any potential impacts and want to design policy that helps avoid any conflicts between scooters and others.
Go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to talk about traffic jams, but that's another rant. So if you want to.
No, I was going to get back to a lot of people wanting to talk about the hearing yesterday.
Let's go. Let's do
had a tweet from Amanda important. Who says, of course Kavanaugh got fired up yesterday. There have been no witnesses to confirm Ford's allegations. The people purportedly said it didn't happen. I'd be getting tired of all this if I was accused and simply did not do it, and witnesses confirmed that.
Well, that's why the Democrats want Mr. Judge, Mark Judge, to who was allegedly in the room, is said by Dr. Ford to be in the room, who has given a statement but has not appeared in a sworn situation where he would be asked questions not only probably about the night in that room, but the book he wrote about the drunkenness of his high school days and his time with Judge Kavanaugh. So the writer has a very good point. You need more information from this. That's why the ABA says we need more information.
But I am sure that Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh are both tired of this, even though it's only been in the public eye for the last few weeks or so. But is being tired of something, is being frustrated about something, enough reason to just simply call an end to it without what some people believe are proper procedures and investigations?
No, you're the politician, but the fact is the Republicans are intending on changing the nature of the U.S. Supreme Court, and they have said as much. They are not going to be delayed, and they're going to push ahead and put this nominee on the court. I mean, that's the politics of it. They're not tired of it. They're tired of the court being not as conservative as they want it to be.
I would just point out, in apropos of our prior conversation, that if it's going to take us 9 months to study the right way to legislate e-scooters in the 26 square miles of Arlington County, certainly a decision that is so much more consequential for so many millions of Americans probably deserves a little bit of time.
We have time for one more call. Here's Laura in Annapolis. Laura, you're on the air. You have about 1 minute.
Okay. I'm not in Annapolis, actually. I'm out of Annapolis, and I was just calling to say that I have a very similar story as Dr. Ford on so many levels, the age, the prestigious private school system, the party, the drinking, the boys. It was never reported, and it's just a secret I've kept to myself. And every time this stuff comes out, it gets a little louder in my head. And with Dr. Ford's story now, it's so loud in my head.
Hence all of the calls that the rape crisis hotlines have been receiving, both here and in the region generally. I say that, Laura, only because our time is up and we have to go at this point. Katie Crystal is chair of the Arlington County Board. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.